Of course, a war kind of awakens this survival instinct and makes you an adult within days. That's what happened to me. Those 5 days and 4 nights over the mountains truly robbed me of my childhood. You are an Afghan? And I felt like saying, for God's sakes, all Afghan women that I know are like me or better than me. And they do fantastic things. Why is it so surprising to you? Of course I know why. Of course I know the media and all that stuff. But the media also shows this one-sided coin. However, it's incomplete facts. There is another life there.
Join explorers and travelers on their journeys and discover distant places and fascinating cultures. From the highest peaks and densest jungles into the heart of adventure, this is Unfolding Maps with Eric Lawrence.
My guest today is artist, author, activist, and filmmaker Nahid Shahilimi. She was born in Afghanistan and grew up in the country's high society because her father was one of the most influential and prosperous persons there. However, eventually she had to flee to Canada with her mother and her sisters. That was in the 80s. She has lived in Pakistan, in India, in the USA, Spain, and Germany. In Montreal, she studied fine art and politics, among other things. Since 2000, she has lived with her 2 daughters in Munich. She's actively involved in many humanitarian projects, both nationally and internationally. And in this conversation, she will talk both about her upbringing, her childhood in Afghanistan, but also about her work today, about shining a spotlight on the women of Afghanistan in particular. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Hi, Nahid. Welcome to Unfolding Maps. I'm very glad that you took the time to meet me.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Yes, we want to talk about Afghanistan today. This is the place where you were born and also where you spent, I think, the first 11 years
11
of
12.
Your life. Yeah, 11 to 12, depending on how you count, probably. I would just like to jump right in the beginning. Would you mind telling us where and how you grew up in Afghanistan?
Well, I was born in Kabul, in the noble districts of Kabul, to a family that was very politically influential, let's just say that. My father was a minister, a few times minister, so I believe, I don't want to quote anything, but I think he was 6 or 7 times minister, different ministeriums.
For example, development minister.
Development, and yes, the development was really important because the German engineers worked with him after the World War II, and there's this huge, you know, friendship between the Germans and the Afghans, and that was that time where they developed the tunnels and the roads and all of that stuff. He was also the education minister and foreign and interior minister. So almost every ministry he went through, and even the Afghans today, and I myself included, we say that the real ministers that loved Afghanistan with all of their hearts and true patriots of Afghanistan were at that time. So he was one of those. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, at that time, you know, the high society of Afghanistan was people that were influentially in power. And we were one of them. So life was comfortable. Let's just say that. Life was very comfortable. And as far as finances were concerned, there were no issues. So all of that put aside, as a child growing up in Kabul, regardless of the financial comforts and privileges, I had the most beautiful childhood a kid could ever dream of. And that is because in Afghanistan at that time, everyone was happy, regardless of how much he had. It was just a peaceful time. Although, you know, I mean, there was the beginning of, you know, the coup d'etat happened, and then after the coup d'etat happened the year that I was born. And then, you know, things took a different turn, and then the communists came, and then, and you know, the whole story of Afghanistan. Still at that time, within Kabul, there was still some sort of a stability. And my father never wanted to leave because he always said, I built this country. This is, I'm quoting him. He said, I built this country with my own bare hands. I will never leave it. And then he got sick. So when he got sick, the Russians were in control at that time, and he needed an operation. And they didn't give him his passport to go outside of the country to get the operations that he needed or the treatments that he needed, because they were always afraid that the, you know, the high society was leaving slowly, either by plane or for whatever X reasons, and then they would leave and they wouldn't come back. And they were like watchdogs on us. And because we were anti-communist, that meant that if you were not in the communist parties or junior communist parties, you were automatically anti-communist. And mm-hmm. that was very well-known fact about the Shahanimis, basically. And the fact that my grandparents from my mother's side were very good friends with the Mujahideen didn't help. Mm-hmm. So, to make a long story short, my dad got very sick and they didn't give him his passport, and then they operated on him. And that was at a time when my mom refused to get the operations, and she was against the operations, but they operated on him anyways. Okay. And I call it an excuse, and the excuse was that it got so bad that we had to operate or else he would have died. He died. So to me, even though there have been explanations, my mother's side and the doctors of that time and all that stuff, I still think that he was killed. I don't believe any other scenario. And after that, and that was 20 days after my 8th birthday. So
before we move even further, I would like to get a little bit of a feeling for the time before that happened, mm-hmm. because I think, yeah, you led a pretty extraordinary life. I think it's been quoted many times. You lived like in a kind of small palace with 37 rooms and a lot of staff members, good food, many interesting people, of course, yes. came to see your father and talk to them, which I guess was also pretty inspiring to see this kind of mm-hmm. interaction. And this kind of interesting different kinds of backgrounds. Probably there were engineers and international people.
International community was always there. Yeah.
Yes, yes. Were you aware of the fact back then that you led an extraordinary life when you were a child?
No, because as a child, when you're happy, you don't care for any money or these Mercedes Benz. We had the only silver Mercedes Benz that existed in all of the country. And I never saw my dad drive that Mercedes because we always had a chauffeur, mm-hmm. literally. I still don't know whether my dad could drive because mm-hmm. I'd never seen him. But to me, that wasn't luxury. That to me, to a child, it's the feeling of the feeling that you give them, the loving, the support that you give them. And that was 500% there. And the huge mansions. I mean, life is completely different in Afghanistan, even today. And back then it was even more because the whole family and families were there. And these are huge families. So the gatherings, the regular normal gatherings on a weekend, which was a Friday night, was minimum 50, 60 people. And there was music. And there was, of course, we Afghans, we need an excuse to have fun, eat, and dance. So basically, it was every single weekend. And because my father was the eldest of the family at that time, out of respect, everybody came to our place. And it was a pretty huge mansion. So the front lawn, which was, I have no idea how big it was, but you could easily put a full volleyball court there. And there was like badminton and ping pong tournaments, and we had tournaments at home inside of the home because everybody was a really excellent ping pong player, the men and the women. So we had huge tournaments, and they would go all the way to the middle of the night. So all of these memories, to me, was just happiness, you know, and happiness, you really don't need a lot of money to be happy. And that was there. And you felt it, and it wasn't about the luxury and or whatever. You don't care at that time, to be honest. All we cared for was the 20 kids that were arriving so we can go somewhere and do some kind of a mischief where we were not supposed to go. So that to me, that was life. And the rest, I mean, afterwards, of course, when you grow up as an adult, then you go back. And especially in the last few years that I've been back so many times, you realize what went on behind the curtains and behind the scenes. But back then, I mean, like I said, financially, to be financially stable gives you a lot of freedom over there as well. But my dad and my mom, they made sure that although we had so many staff and cleaning ladies and cooks and all of that stuff, nobody ever cleaned our rooms. Mm-hmm. We had to clean our rooms. We had to do all of our chores, and everything was very basic. We weren't allowed to, you know, there wasn't a lot of money back then either. It was just, you know, nobody had these Marke Sachen and all that stuff, you know, like to get
the brands.
I'm going back to German, but yes. But to have the brands or the Gucci's and the Chanel's and all that stuff, nobody cared for that, you know. And there were some that cared, and they brought it back from Europe, because my dad always had these European stuff also that were, you know, given as gifts, or he just ordered them. But he made sure that we were very, you know, down to earth. Mm-hmm. So we had seamstresses that would make our clothes, for example, for us. Or my mom loved to make clothes, so she did that. But once a year, we were allowed to go to this, you know, this shop that was very famous, and it had only European and North American stuff. We were allowed to go there and buy only one single thing, and that was for our birthdays. So I grew up, although we were literally, I mean, now I know that we were filthy rich. That feeling was never, you know, it wasn't a given. Mm-hmm. We had to appreciate the hard work that my dad, because my dad was a very poor man when he started. And back then, you know, he just got commissions, land everywhere. And then what he did is that he invested in those lands, like, you know, all around the country. And that's how he got his wealth. So he wanted to make sure that we, as his four daughters, knew the value of hard work. And I am so glad that my mom and my dad raised us that way, because when you lose it, because we did lose it, you know, within the blink of an eye, it was gone because of that war, because we left everything behind and we left with absolutely nothing and started from zero. Starting from zero becomes very easy for you, because you have done it so many times, because you don't really put a lot of value on the material things. So he and my mom both made sure that materialism never came as priority for us, but rather values did.
I think I read somewhere that he told you something like, only what you have in your head and in your heart is something that no one can take away from
you. Exactly. That's what he taught me always. And I was very close to my dad. I followed him. I got into trouble out of all of my sisters because I always followed him. And there were ministers that I saw on TV, and there were some really big people that I saw on TV, and I would just be somewhere hiding in the under the table. I just wanted to be close to him. Yeah. I didn't even know what they were talking about. All I did was that once in a while look at him, and he would look back at me.
Yeah.
And to see, I was just there doing my own thing. But so I was always following him, and he always told me, he said, whatever you do, make sure that you invest in your brain, he always said, and have a good, clean heart. And if you combine both, you will never, ever not be successful. You will always be successful. And that was his words. And I would never, never forget that. And I really took it to the heart. And I mean, to be honest, isn't that really the true success is not monetary. I mean, it depends also success. What does success mean to you? Success to me is fulfillment. If I am fulfilled, I love what I do. I cannot wait to wake up and live my day. And it has been a hard road, you know, the past 15, 20 years of my life, where I have decided to go to the unconventional way of basically, you know, earning my bread. But it does work if you really hang on to it long enough. Yeah. and just not be afraid of trying. What do you have to lose?
Was it ever difficult for him that he had four daughters but no sons in the society back then?
Yes. He didn't regret. He loved us literally, because it happens often, especially in our cultures, where when girls are born, then it's not, you know, there's like a huge sadness that comes to the family. That wasn't the case. He gave us everything, basically. But I knew what his worries were. Little did I know back then, you know, because the Sharia law does not allow women that are left behind after the head of the family passes away, like my father did. Still, that 1/8 would have been enough for all of us to be, you know, to be okay. 1/8 of what is left.
That is what, what would have given
to the women.
Yes.
But there was enough wealth for everybody. But it's the fact that we were anti-communists at that time, where the communist regime was taking over. Some members of my family were in the communist parties, and they literally took everything. They took everything, and it got really dangerous for us as women, because we didn't have a brother. If we had a brother, That's when I found out why. All of my life I heard from the, you know, from surroundings, from neighbors, from you know, people in the family, in the gatherings that happened all the time in our house. Oh, only if Shahalimi would have a son. And I hated them for that because I thought that they just didn't like us.
Not good enough.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And I, to be honest, I mean, today, I mean, I'm old enough to say, oh my God, I've lived like five lifetimes, literally. That's how it feels. But today, when I think back and I analyze this little girl, Nahid, you know, I see myself as a completely outsider, and I look at Nahid and what she did in her life until today, it was to prove not only to my father, not only to my mother, but also to the whole society and the community and the Afghan community that she was enough. I don't have to do it anymore. I came to peace with this, but it only, it only happened just a few years ago. 4 or 5 years ago, that little girl still existed, where she still wanted to prove, yes, I can do this. Because it's not normal when I look back and I'm saying, oh my God, I moved, and I, you know, you clean up a lot of the stuff that you don't clean up in years. And then I went through this box where I found all of these diplomas. I was talking to you about this earlier. I found all of these diplomas and these certificates, and I'm getting, oh my God, yeah, that's true. Oh yes, I was a TESOL teacher. I was an aerobic teacher. I was a personal trainer, certified. All of them were certifications that I was able to not only to go and you know, to teach and make a little bit more money during the time of university to pay university off, but also to prove to something, because it cannot be that you want to do this. Yes, I love life. I'm passionate about everything that I do. And I love all of these different things, very different things that don't, you know, correlate with any. None of them have some kind of a puzzle together. They're all completely black and white and red and blue and don't combine if you really look at it. But I loved all of them and I went after all of them. I don't regret any of it. But I'm not too sure if I had a so-called normal upbringing where, you know, I wasn't always compared to a man, to a non-existing brother that I should have had, whether I would do the same things. I'm not too sure.
Yeah, that was one of the questions I asked myself when preparing for the interview and reading your books and looking at your work. It's an interesting question. Maybe it's not.
I ask myself this. I will never know.
Yes.
I will never know because that's the upbringing.
So what about your mother? What was she like back then?
Very strict.
Yes.
My mommy. Oh, she was here until yesterday, by the way. Nice. She flew yesterday morning. Yes. Back to Canada. But my mom was, I think...
she was much younger than your father?
A lot younger.
60 years younger?
Yes.
Yes.
Approximately.
Yes.
You'll never know because Afghans, to be honest, there are very few Afghans that tell you the truth about their age. So they say that my father was about 83, 85 when he passed. And my mom was approximately 26, 27. So there was a huge difference, a huge gap between the two. Even for Afghanistan, for a place like Afghanistan where things like this happen all the time, a gap like that is huge. To have a 14-year-old get married to a 70-year-old was a huge thing. I loved my dad. He was a great dad. And he was a great husband to my mom. But I do have contradictions today when if I allow myself to go into a deep thought, which I don't allow myself to do often, because it takes me to a dark place that I don't want to be. The work that I have chosen to do today is exactly against what he did. To see my mom be alone most of her life, and she decided not to get married or even have a boyfriend because of the name, because of the status, because of the community, because of what we would have thought of her. And all of these, you know, all of these stamps that we give ourselves, judgments that we already give ourselves, criticisms that we give ourselves. And I saw this beautiful human being. She's a beautiful human being. Go through that by choice, but of course it's unnatural, and she stepped onto her you know, wills and all of these wishes or forms of wants that she had in her life, on purpose, consciously, just to prove a point that she is a worthy woman. That is the most painful thing that you go through. To see your mother go through such suffering, a human being through such suffering, just because she is a woman, because of that gender. And us leaving a country, not only because of the war, but because we were women. That, of course, I'm not going to be whatever normal is these days. And you're supposed to be normal. I don't know whatever normal is today. Today, I'm not too sure about the norms today either. But that you know, that box of, you know, upbringing, so to speak, a normal upbringing, is not something that you take with you. Basically, you don't stay normal. It is impossible after going through such a thing. You cannot stay normal. About the gender question, basically.
Yeah, so what is interesting about that to me is that your mom and you made so different decisions or drew so different conclusions from all of this. For you, I think it was a motivation to prove to yourself and the world, maybe not consciously for a long time, that you could do all of these things. While your mom, who also was like a little bit a victim of this whole society and the approach and the way the Afghan society thought about women and their rights, more or less, it seems like how you summarize it now, willingly went along with it. And not only while she was in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. but for her whole life after that.
Yes. Yes, that's what it was.
And how do you talk about these things today?
I'm very close to my mom today. We still have a lot of issues that we don't. You know, we don't agree, but we accept each other. So she doesn't, you know, she doesn't, I think that she has this relationship now with all four of us, where we tell her the truth about what we think, because there's also another aspect of respect in my culture where, in my opinion, you do not tell the truth to your close family members out of respect. And we were able to, in the last 30 years or plus that we have been outside of Afghanistan, to speak to her in a way that we will tell you the truth, because that to us is now a lie. And this lie is kind of covered through wording, which is called RESPCT, respect. And that, we changed it in her and I think in within our family, but it took a lot of work. And it was an exhausting work, to be honest. Today, I'm exhausted to have done that. And if anybody in my family and surroundings that I choose to have a relationship with comes with some kind of an idiocy and stupidity that I call today and label it respect, I call it a lie. And I don't want to have anything to do with it. There's an issue right now in my family where getting married to younger women or something like that if something like that happens, it is a huge issue. But without breaking the family, me personally, I would choose not to have anything to do with that person, although we're blood related. And I don't feel bad about it. And my mother accepts that, mm-hmm. although it is very close family, like the first circle of family. And these are the things that I find acceptable, because you don't have to, you know, we were taught to be friendly and nice and kind to all members of our family, regardless of what they did. And we were able to break away from that. It was a lot of pain was there. There was a lot of pain, and there's still a lot of pain to be worked with. But I think that if we don't make these changes in the traditions and cultures and philosophy behind a culture, basically, then I don't think that person has the right to even complain about it. If you're going to complain about something, first and foremost, what are you going to do about it? You either accept it, so then stop complaining, or you choose to change it. Then what is your role in this change? So I look at it this way. There's only two options. If you're unhappy about something, you will complain. Then you have the right to complain if you're going to do something to change it. I don't give you the right to complain, nor am I going to be there to listen to it if you're not going to do something to change it, because it's hypocrisy to me then. You do it and you still complain about it. I know that it's not easy. I know that it's like staying in a relationship, whether man, woman, or whatever the gender may be, and, you know, complaining from morning to night about this person. But what are you doing to change it? You still do the same things. Then either leave or stay and fix it and literally shut up, you know, because it's the same formula in everything. They're like, we spoke about the strategies like just a few minutes ago
before we started the recording. Yeah. Yes.
Before we started the recording, there's a strategy about everything. Make a strategy, put your action plan, just do it. And stop complaining, because there's a beautiful life out there, regardless of all of these things that I'm talking to you about, which may seem very heavy to some of your listeners, right? But it is a part of life. It is the yin and the yang. It is the black and the white. It is the, you know, the morning and the night, whatever you want to call it. These two sides of a balanced life has to be there. It will always be there. Pain will always be there. Sorrow will always be there. But so will happiness. So you choose which way to go. You just decide. I mean, I just decide that I'm not staying in that, you know, negative mode or negative box for too long. I will always go back. There will always be negative moments. But I know how to, hopefully, in the future as well. I don't want to talk too ahead of myself. But I have found a way to step out of it as soon as possible and not linger, which takes a lot of energy out of you.
In the 60s, when your dad prospered, I think, and also in the 70s, which is when you were born, I think these were the years and the decades in Afghanistan that were kind of called the golden years. Yes. Today, right? So what was the situation of women back then in Afghanistan?
In the big cities, when I wrote the book.
Yes.
And I literally, you know, I painted it this way as well. And it was like that. Women have had a lot of rights constitutionally on paper. Afghan women have always had a lot of rights. They were allowed to do so much, and where certain parts of the world in the Western world were not even allowed to do so. So, voting and all of that stuff, you know, and parliament and ministers and everybody. But it was in the big cities. Conservative society was always Afghanistan, regardless of the times. And this is what we don't always talk about. And I'm not too sure whether I made the statement in the book, but I know that I make it in every panel that I sit today. I guess it's a learning process as well. Although the book was sent into printing in end of 2016, and it came out in 2017. If I was to rewrite that book, I most probably will rewrite it a little bit differently today, because I have learned a lot more after, through the panels, through the presentations, through the literally dozens of tours. And I'm still going on tour for this book, because it's so, you know, it's such an important issue. Mm-hmm. Because, when it comes to women's rights in Afghanistan, on paper, we have a lot of rights. Society does not allow a lot of rights. That's the difference between us, Afghanistan, Afghans, and the Persians, the Iranians, for example. The Iranian society is very, very, very ready to do a lot more than what the constitution allows them, but the constitution does not allow them. So by law, we are allowed to do so. Society does not allow it, which is much stronger. But, you know, you have, because changing the mindsets of people takes a long time, and it's a very long and very harsh process. Whereas, you know, if you lobby and you're a good politician and a good lobbyist groups, then you can change the law.
Yes.
You know, but now we may go back because of the Taliban, because they may go back and change the laws. These are the clauses that they want to change. And the reason why people like me, who are not affiliated to any political groups or anything like that, we do lobby in a very peaceful manner, but in a very, you know, concrete manner, to say, do not allow anybody to touch that constitution. Because if you touch the constitution, then me and you cannot go in Afghanistan and promote women's rights, because we would be considered criminals. This is the real fact at the moment. So back then in the 60s and 70s, women just flourished, and they were allowed to do everything that they wanted to. They were mini jupes and name it. It was like the Western world. And if you look at the photos, you wouldn't think that it was Kabul. It's literally like that. However, if you went outside of Kabul, even in Kabul, then you did have the burqa, not the burqa, but the chadari, mm-hmm. the blue, you know, the blue long veil with holes in where you can see through it. But But the conservative families did not touch the open-minded families and vice versa. Everybody accepted everybody. And that was what was beautiful. Nobody cared what you did in your own home, as long as you had respect for the Afghan. And there was only an Afghan. Today, you go to Afghanistan and people ask you, where you come from? And you're speaking in Dari. And you're going, well, where do you think I come from? From China? Of course I'm Afghan. No, which part of Afghanistan do you come from? And this, you know, this distinctions, the separations have created such horrible things. It's really, really horrible to be separated within a country where there's like 50 different folks, and it has always been like that. But nobody's ever asked me back then. I don't remember anybody asking anybody, where do you come from? In Farsi or in Dari or in Pashto. Today, the first thing that they ask you, oh, where do you come from? But they know that you're an Afghan. And I always, to be honest, I don't know where I come from, because everybody from in my family, my grandparents come from all over the country. So I couldn't tell you. Yeah, my grandmother is from Badakhshan. My father was from part from Kandahar, from part from Ghazni, from part from this and part of that. So I have blood from all over the country, and I refuse to answer anything else. But I am an Afghan.
When do you think that changed? Was it like when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan? Was this the beginning of this transformation that led from back then to what you described about today? They invaded in 1979, and I think this also led through some steps to the reign of the Taliban many years later.
I think it started way before that. You know, the revolution happened, the coup d'etat happened in 73. And before, we all know that before a coup d'etat or a revolution like that happens, there's a lot of back lobbying behind the scene that happens, so that it basically points the people to revolt at that point. Mm-hmm. So it must have, I mean, it took many years to basically defame the monarchy or you know, because it was the cousin of the Shah that made the coup d'etat. Daoud was Zahir Shah's cousin, and while his family was in Europe, he overthrew the government. So it took about 6 years, and they killed him too, right? When the communists came and they just shot everybody in Daoud's family from A to Z. And there was, I think, a couple of people that survived in that family because they were outside of the country. That's why. So you always need one person that has this, that believes in this illusion of a better Afghanistan or a better cooperation with this world power or that world power in order to destabilize a country. So the country was destabilized because, a lot of people call him a fool. A lot of people love him. A lot of people do this, but somebody believed that Afghanistan would be a better place if I cooperate with the communists. At the end, he paid for his life and his family's life. And then there were, you know, how it worked. So I think that the change came way before 79. The fabric of this war was made way before 73 even.
Okay. After this invasion, 2 years after that, was the year when your father died. We already talked about that. And this, of course, also meant that a lot changed for you and your life. You already hinted at the Sharia law, which mm-hmm. would have said that your mom and your sisters and you should have gotten 1/8 of the property, of the wealth, of everything that he owned. Mm-hmm. But your cousins, who were getting 7/8 anyway, they wanted to have it all.
Yes.
And they didn't accept this law and more or less, stole it from you and drove your mom away, right? Out of your house.
Well, they wanted to kidnap us and sell us even to the warlords. That was the day my mom decided that she wasn't going to stay for one more minute. The reason why she wanted to stay was because my dad never wanted to leave. And she always had this idea because she was in love with my dad. She was. And that's what I never understood. So that's when people say, that's why I said before, earlier, I have a lot of contradictions in me. My mom cried for years after my dad died, but not because she loved this man. She truly, truly loved this man. And he loved her. But these cousins, and these were my male cousins, three of them. The rest were all kosher and okay. But my these three, who actually were raised by my father. As they were, when they were children, their dad, my uncle, died. So he took them under his wing and he said, I will never allow them to think that they didn't have a father. So he became his, their second father. He sent them to like boarding schools and they all got their degrees, really professional. One of them became a doctor, one became an engineer and blah, blah, blah. And he threw their weddings, which is a huge thing in Afghanistan. You know, their weddings, like, it costs a lot of money, and bought them houses, full houses, villas. And he just set them up for life, basically. And then when he died, the first people that literally started looting, and I mean it, looting and stealing, and they would have skinned us alive, were these three. That's when, you know, and I was 8 years old. So at that early, naive stage of life, when you're faced with stuff like this from a, you know, from a safe haven of beautiful childhood and a family that really cared for values, you are slapped with something like that. It has a huge effect on you. It has a huge effect on you as a child, but as a woman, because they were male. And this idea of man and woman is already formed in the worst way possible for an 8 year old. So having lived that, having seen that, having verbally seen the languages that they used in front of us, and my mom and my dad never allowed anybody to use any kind of language in front of us. We didn't even know we didn't even know 90% of the swear words in Farsi. I had to learn it here when I was like an adult, literally. I learned it from my husband. I had no idea what those words meant. I know more swear words in English than any other language because, you know, I grew up in Canada and that's where I learned it.
Yes.
That's the first thing you learn, by the way, anyways, in any language, but not in Derry. I didn't. So for us to be faced with something like that, we were in shock. We were in complete, total shock for years and we just couldn't understand. So I personally, I can only speak for myself here. I personally developed an incredible amount of hate. And it was truly hate. It's a strong word, but I developed this huge hate towards these three and towards anybody that would come close to hurting my mother because she suffered and I saw her and I heard her in the middle of the night, although she tried to hide it from us. But it wasn't, you know, because she was so protective of us. All of a sudden she left everything and she just cared. And we were very close to her all of a sudden because we were tiny. You know, and she would get threats from these three. She would get my grandfather and my grandmother who came and lived with us right away because this mansion was huge. My grandfather was kidnapped many times and almost killed a few times, and he was just a fluke that he survived, and that was all their work. Just because I have no idea what it was. It wasn't enough for them to have this 7/8. They took everything that was in the provinces, everything. This is a lot of money. And of course, rumors are, oh yeah, this person did this. But I saw what I saw. And then my mom decided one day, because they had called and threatened to kidnap us and sell us to the warlords because we were pretty and we would make a lot of money. So that's when she decided. And they literally drafted a mastermind plan. Which was like the movies, you know. We left the big huge house. They rented it to somebody because they needed the money, and they had to get money somewhere, liquid money, to pay for the smugglers, so nobody would notice. So you couldn't go to the banks or sell something because they would know. So we rented the house because it was way too big for us, and we went to our grandparents' small 3-bedroom apartment. In these huge compounds that the Russians had made. And we moved, all of us, we moved there. So we had one room, we were five of us, we had one room and we slept all on the floor and my mom slept on the bed and blah, blah, blah. So we did the whole thing for about, I don't know how many months. And then the next plan was that there was, and that was a, I think that was a just a lucky thing that happened. There was this bug that infested the apartments everywhere and it infested ours. So that was the perfect scenario for us to leave. We had to leave because there was a bug infestation in the whole building. So we had to, you know, for 1 week they had to come and they had to spray and blah, blah, blah. So we had to leave. And that was the night that we left. So it was a mastermind plan that was planned. And
My grandfather and my mom, they paid smugglers and told everybody, not everybody, but once, because they had spies everywhere. They told a few people, oh, we're leaving from this route. But we actually left and paid another group of smugglers and left from Jalalabad. That's how they didn't find us.
Did you ever in later years get in touch with these cousins again or heard anything of them? Do you know what became of them?
I wanted to. One of them died. My sister, my oldest sister, I'm the second oldest. So my older sister got to see two of them and they couldn't look her in the eye. There was one that was alive and I went in 2011, to do research to see, okay, what's going on and when should I come, blah, 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 for 6 days or 7 days. I was in Kabul in 2011. And another one was alive. The doctor was alive and I wanted to see it. My mom was with me and she didn't allow me. She was too scared because it is dangerous. You know, these people don't have anything to lose and they would just hire somebody for 1,000 and they would kill you basically. Because the minute that Shah Alimi would go into the country, people get nervous because they're under this law. You know, it would take a few years, but we are entitled to everything that my father owned. And it's a lot of money still. It's just very dangerous to go in. And the minute that you walk in, people get nervous and they can hijack you and kill you, basically, because there's a lot of money involved. People have to pay for the things that they have, you know, bought for 10,000 and it was worth 1 million. And they never asked whose it is. And they just signed a paper. So the laws are back into normal. But it just takes a long time. It's a long process and it's very dangerous for us. So my mom got scared and she didn't allow me to see him. But there is one, the last one who's alive in London somewhere. And it was funny because I was sitting in the Emirates in one of these trips and I was coming back and I was working on my computer. And this man that was right beside me, you know, I was working and then he started talking to me. He said, oh, yeah, so which family? They always ask you, which family do you come from? And then I said, yes, Shah Alimi. And then he said, well, do you know this person, Shah Alimi? And I started laughing. And he kept on saying, oh, how great of a man he is. He was supposedly his best friend. And I waited and I waited. I said to myself, meditate, just breathe. You don't have to. He talked so long that he wouldn't just shut up, to be honest. And I just had to. I think the poor guy thought, why in the world did I speak to this crazy woman? Because I said, well, it's great that you do that. Did you know?
I have a little story to tell you.
So he didn't like, I don't know. And I saw this man again. He's the CEO of some company in Afghanistan on another occasion. And when I said, don't worry, I'm not going to talk. I just want to say hello. Good to see you. But yes, one of them is alive. And to be honest, it's Afghanistan is gone. Those times, I mean, in Afghanistan are gone. And I don't want to open that chapter. I've worked with it. It took a long time to, you know, find peace. And it does no good. You know, they did what they thought was right. If I ever come across them and they dare to say hello to me and do this BS respect thing, oh, they will hear it. I mean, he will hear it. He's the only one. But I don't think any Shah Alimi dares to even open their mouths when it comes to this. But the rest of the Shah Alimis are great to us. And some of them, you know, we have contact. Some of them we don't. But it's only these three that I had that I for a long time I wanted to face them. But now I don't have the urge anymore.
Could you take us back to your escape? How did you?
Oh, that was fun.
How did you flee?
I remember it was the middle of the night. We had to go to a very modest friends of my grandmother's. And we changed our clothing to basically like villager's clothing. And we had the chadari. And in the morning we had to take a bus. And then there was like, it took about 5 days and four nights to go over the mountains through Jalalabad and wait for him. Sometimes there was part of it that we were in a jeep. And it was a tiny little jeep where we were on top of each other. And then there was like a huge blanket on us so that we can go through the checkpoints. We passed one checkpoint and then before the next ones, we had to get out and then we just kept on walking. So it was a lot of walking. And then the next, I think it was 2 days later, we got donkeys because some of the paths were too dangerous, basically. And the donkeys knew the way. So there was a guide in the front and in the back, and the donkeys just had done it. I guess they had done it so many times, they just knew the way. And so we had donkeys the last 3 days. But we ate and slept and drank from whatever we could find on the way. We had some nuts and bread, and that was gone after the first day. For me as a child, it was so much fun. Like adventure, pure adventure. I would not give those 5 days away for anything. But today as a mom, I do not want to have to go through that with my daughters.
Yeah, because you describe it as an adventure, but didn't you feel the worry, the fear of your mom? I mean, no. It must have been such a terrible situation for her.
For her, yes. Today, as a mom, yes. But back then, I mean...
Not only as a mom, also just as a person. You lost your husband, you lose your friends, you lose your house, your life.
For sure.
And you take your kids into the mountains to go into the unknown.
Yeah, to safety, basically. Because that is a better option. Yes. That was a better option to take the chance of dying than to stay in Kabul, because we would have died anyways. We would have either, and worse than dying would have been to be kidnapped and sold to one of these stupid warlords, who is like 80 years old, and they would have married one of us, you know, back then. As a child, now I go back to the child's, to Nahid, the child. We were not allowed to go anywhere because we were the Shahalimis. We were always escorted. We were always with somebody. We were not allowed to go. Everybody came to our home because of the fact that my parents didn't want us to go so much to the other house, because it was a safety issues, name it. So they always had these, although we had this beautiful mansion and everybody was there, but for us, this was like, wow, life. We saw life. We were never allowed to eat with our hands in our home. You know, Afghans outside in the villages, they eat with their hands. That was so cool, you know? And for us to be on donkeys, oh my God. We were like the perfect little princesses that spoke well, that didn't swear, and all of that stuff. That was our structured life, you know? Every single day we went to school, every single afternoon, there was a private teacher that taught us other things. That's boring for a 12-year-old, for God's sake. Now, this was life for me. So that's how I looked at it. Of course, it was tiring. You know, and one night wolves caught us because it was so dark and we couldn't see. All I remember was a pack of wolves that tried to attack our donkeys. And all you saw was these lights, the eyes. That's it. So, I mean, that was scary. You know, on top of the mountains, sometimes the donkeys would be too scared to go, so they would just bend their necks, and then you would slide off, and you may have died because you would fall off the cliff. And those moments were scary, but the rest of it was just fun. We were like 7-8 of us on donkeys and having a blast, literally. But now, like you say, as an adult, I look at it back and I'm going, oh my God, how in the world did this woman survive 1 minute of it? Because as a mom, your whole life stops, literally. Literally, your whole life stops the minute that tiny little thing comes in this world. You are all about that tiny little thing, to protect it, to save it, to give it the best there is. That's a motherhood. And it happened to me, and now she had four of them. With that kind of, like you said, that kind of background, that kind of, you know, worries, huge worries. But I think that at that moment, adrenaline kicks in. And the only thing that you think about is, how do I survive this day? Because you don't know whether tomorrow, what's going to tomorrow. We didn't know when were we going to arrive. They kept on saying, oh, after this mountain. You go up and down the mountains, up and never was an ending mountain chains. Non-ending. It was beautiful. But after a while, you say, oh, for God's sakes.
I would be ready.
Yeah.
Yes.
To sleep somewhere and eat properly. There was nothing. You were always hungry. You were always thirsty. You were always tired. But it was fun for us.
You went back to Afghanistan many years later. You already mentioned that, 2011, I think was...
The first time was 2011.
Yes, so many years later. And then repeatedly, I think starting in 2014, you kept going back to work on a book project. You also already mentioned it. Mm-hmm. And as far as I know, it has thus far only been released in German, right? Okay. The English title would be something like Where Courage Carries the Soul, We Women in Afghanistan. What was the motivation behind this book?
I was sick and tired of, to be honest, every time that I walked into, because in my work, it's very, very, like, how do you say it? It's in the open. So I was sick and tired of walking into an event, onto a panel, as a speaker, as a, whatever that I did. And the first question would be, oh, you are an Afghan? And I felt like saying, for God's sakes, all Afghan women that I know are like me or better than me. And they do fantastic things. Why is it so surprising to you? Of course I know why. Of course I know the media and all that stuff. But the media also shows this one-sided coin that the minute that you think of Afghanistan, there's only women that don't, that are suppressed, that are, yes, their rights are violated, they have nothing, they don't know how to read and write, and they are being killed and stoned, basically. Which is not all, you know, wrong or they're facts. However, it's incomplete facts. There is another life there. There is another woman, Afghan. What is an Afghan woman? First of all, you know, you cannot put everybody in the same pot and make a big, huge stew out of it. That's not the way it works. And whether you go to America or to Canada or any other, or even Germany, what is a German woman? Give me somebody from Munich, and give me somebody from Köln, and give me somebody from Hamburg, and give me somebody from the furthest village in Bavaria. They will speak four different languages. I'm telling you, four different dialects. And I do speak German, and I speak it very well. And I won't understand anybody probably properly, especially the Bavarian one, which is a complete different dialect. So same thing goes for Afghanistan. So why are we so quick to stamp a country that has bled for the past 40 years and stamp as one single entity, persona, the Afghan woman? So I was against this. It bothered me because there was nobody that was interested in showing such things. At that time, when I started thinking about this project, this is like 2012, 2013, when I spoke to my publisher, there was absolutely nothing that was out there that was for this kind of stuff, you know? And I started doing the research, and I told, and my publisher actually was her idea, because We the Women of Afghanistan was not on my to-do list, not at that time, because my kids were still small and I wanted to stay a couple of more years and then start doing the traveling. When I went to my publisher and she said, well, I'm not interested in this We the Women, but if you want to do the We the Women of Afghanistan, I'm in. Within 2 weeks, we signed the contract. And then I had to find a way to go. I had to find my network. Good thing is that I had done this huge project in 2012, which was very successful. And that was, I did portraits of the German national soccer team, the 2016 World Cup winners.
As an artist, like paintings.
Yes, I'm the painter. Mm-hmm. The painter, and he did that. Mm-hmm. But the whole idea of the paintings was also to have a vision, to have a voice. So all of these projects have a voice, and a gap that I see in certain parts of the society that needs to be filled, I initiate such a project, but in a creative way so that it stays interesting. Mm-hmm. And of course, to my loves, to my passions. Like I said, I can't just be one thing. I'm all of these things. Maybe mediocre, maybe good, maybe not excellent, because you need a lot of time to excel in one thing. But I love being mediocre in these things. I love being good at these things, not excellent, but do them at least, because I wouldn't be complete if I didn't. And so I decided, and so this German Soccer for Life 2012 was extremely successful. And BBC did a reportage on that, a long reportage in Persian. Mm-hmm. BBC Persia did that. And little did I know that the minute that this BBC report came out, hundreds of thousands of people got interested. And BBC kept on, of course, it was, you know, it had a lot of audience, so it kept on showing it. We hit if you calculate all of the numbers of people that saw it, it was over 1 million to 2 million people in different channels. And I didn't know this. And then I received all of a sudden within 2 months or 3 months, my little Facebook page from like 5,000 followers turned to 100,000 followers. And they were all from that region, from Afghanistan, Persia, Bangladesh, Iraq even. So all of these war-torn countries and then this unstable region, basically, followed me. And then it became easier. So journalists from Afghanistan contacted me through Facebook. We wanted to have an interview, blah, blah, blah. And I said, no, we don't. So that was the strategy. I said, okay, well, why don't you do this? Just do this. And within weeks, I was able to organize everything. And the good thing about Afghans is that once they know that you need help, especially the journalists and this community, this educated community, and also everybody basically in Afghanistan, they are so ready to help you. And I had forgotten that part of Afghanistan because I was so much in fury and in hate of what had happened all of these years. Although I always knew that I was going to go back. I always knew that I was going to go back to Afghanistan. I always knew that I wanted to do all of these things. Which shape and form it took, I didn't know. But I knew that I was going to write these books. I knew that I was going to make films. I knew that I was going to do all of these things. And then all of a sudden, it was like an epiphany. Hallelujah.
It all came together.
It came together. And I said, I own this. What are you afraid of? That all of these barriers that I had personally made for myself, nobody else made it. You know, at the end of the day, we all make it ourselves. It just fell one after the other, and it was so clear. And it went smooth. Yes, it took a long time because I didn't want to leave more than 2 weeks at a time, because I didn't want to leave my kids more. I would miss them, and they would miss me. And it was just a time that was not right for me to leave them so long, because I could have done this in 6 months if I had stayed there for 2 months twice, but I didn't want to. And it was too dangerous for my girls to be there, and they had school and blah, blah, blah. So all of that stuff. But that's what happened, basically.
How was it for you in the end to go back to Afghanistan and to see these places again, to meet these people again?
I loved it. I loved every single minute of it. I would go again and again and again and again. I feel, although there is a huge war raging, when you talk about infrastructure, a lot of the places that you go, there's not a lot of infrastructure. Electricity, for example, is not always there. And it is difficult to move around, especially for a blue-eyed girl that looks like European. You know, I'm number one target. And doing the work that I do.
Which kind of danger did you experience or
kidnappings? Perceive? Well, being at the right, at the wrong place at the wrong time, the suicide bombers. I've been very close to the bombs. A couple of them. One of them is actually, it happened while we were filming outside of the compound that we were filming. It happened and it was right there. And then I dropped everything and I went to the scene, which is a bad thing to do because these days, you know, they have these double bombs that they wait for everybody to get together and then they blow up the next one. So, but, you know, when you go to places like Afghanistan, you already accept, you don't think about these things, because why would you go if you think about these things? You don't. You just don't. If you are afraid, you cannot do this work. So somehow something happens the minute that, you know, you get, it's not, I mean, there's a term for people like us and the journalists that are in wars, and they say war junkies. That's what they call them. I don't think we're war junkies. I think that it's because you see the results of what you do and the work that we do. You see the results right away, like the next 24 hours. Because if you help somebody, you see the results right away. If a person actually does a report and it has its effect actually happens within the next few days, and you see that, and that doesn't happen often in other places. So when it came to danger in Afghanistan and being close to these bombs and stuff like that, of course you are taking care of the logistics. You know, you don't take the same route all the time. You within 1 week you meet all of the diasporas, how they do their things. You meet all of these, the international community, your contacts, your network builds up. And the fact that, you know, you have a little bit of a portfolio in the back helps you to get to the green zones and to get these, you know, these so-called acquaintances and friends who help you. Because a war zone is not Paris or Munich. You know, you need different kind of logistics for those things. And everybody knows that it is truly a matter of life and death if they don't help you. So everybody's very open, and it takes a certain kind of character to do this kind of a job. So that's why when you go to places like that, you meet the most interesting people in terms of, you know, characters, personas, because they think they're in the same wavelength as you are. So therefore, it becomes very, very easy to open up And you become friends. And I have so many friends that are, you know, and these people move around. So it's the same people. Some people I've seen, the same people, for example, the assistant to the Canadian ambassador, whom I met, I think it was 2015, 2016, in Kabul, talking about something. I go to Iraq, like just a few months ago, and she was the ambassador, the consul in Erbil. And I'm going, Nancy, I said, wait a minute, I know you. We know each other. And we started hugging each other after 3 years. And we met in Kabul. So, and that same thing happens everywhere. So where are you now? I'm in Tunis. Oh, okay, good. How about this? I'm in Uganda. Okay, I'm coming and doing a project in Uganda. So you, your whole life turns into something completely different that you did not expect, but beautiful. You got to be open for it though. So that's why, you know, it's a certain kind of a character and a persona that it takes in order to do such work and not be afraid. The first thing that you do, you got to get rid of your fear or else you can't do this job.
We have mentioned at least the beginning of the reign of the Taliban. How would you describe the political situation in Afghanistan today?
That's the million-dollar question.
Yes.
How do I... I think that it is not up to the Afghans to make the decisions for Afghanistan, unfortunately. There are too many outside hands involved in Afghanistan and in the faith of the Afghans. And not only the faith of Afghans that who live in Afghanistan, but faith of Afghans all over the world, to be honest. Taliban, whether Taliban or another extremist group, of course, if you ask anybody, any Afghan and anybody in the world that works, you know, in the field that we do, they would be against them coming back. However, if you look at the other side and try to be realistic about things, most of the country is still very conservative. So in order to find like a middle point with the Taliban involved, with the government involved, with the international community involved, I am not too sure whether these extremes are even, you know, matchable to a certain degree. Because the mindsets are so extreme in both sides. And now you're talking about 60 plus percent of the country who is under the age of 28, 27, who are very educated, who have seen the world, who are like a child that was born in the post era is now almost 20 years old. How in the world do you expect them to go back to the, you know, 6th century, 7th century? Sharia ways of life, where a woman is not even allowed to go and educate herself after the 6th or 7th grade. Because the controlled areas, where the Taliban controlled these areas, that's what's happening. They keep on saying, yes, you can go to the school and all that. The women can go to school. They can work and all the rest of the stuff that we are asking for, basically, the Afghans are asking for. They say, yeah, of course, we're going to allow you to work. Of course, you're going to go to school. However, they don't allow that in the areas that they're controlling right now. So what is the guarantee that the international community has that are saying that, yes, they have changed? What have they changed? They have not changed. They have not also said that they have changed. They keep on saying that this is the way it is, and they're actually practicing that. And somehow the international community has become deaf to these cries. I understand that this war has to end, and it has to end. The bloodshed has to end. The killings have to end. And it's the civilians that pay for the price, not the Taliban, not the international community, but the civilians and that has to stop. Yes, because you need some kind of a stability in order for the country to prosper. Because in order for this country, for the young people that have, you know, created life for themselves, for them to prosper and add to the development of the country so that we can build the country together with the diasporas, with the outside world, with everybody, just like a, so to speak, normal country, but not at the cost of pillars of human rights. And I'm not only talking about the women's rights. I'm talking about minority rights, religious rights, youth rights, whatever you want to call it. Women's rights is just one tiny little pillar of the human rights, and we're not even talking about the rest of it. So at what cost are we, you know, ready to sign these peace treaties or peace agreements or even talk about it? You know, where is the Afghan government? Where are the women? Where is the civil society? None of them or very few of them are on those negotiating tables. Who is negotiating for my right when I go back and I do my work? Who? But I make, my gender makes at least 50% of the country, if not more. So it is a very tough time, but a very, very important pivotal time for Afghanistan. And we're writing history right now. But it is in the hands of the, especially the US, because they're doing the negotiations mainly, and the other powers. So we will have to simply wait and watch.
So you said it's a pivotal time right now. Do you feel that significant progress is being made at the moment?
Oh, for sure. Oh, well, you mean as far as the peace talks are concerned?
For example, yes.
The framework, I'm not even too sure whether we're still allowed to call it a peace talk, because it's the frameworks that are being, yes, built for the peace talk. I'm not too sure. I mean, progress in a way that they are listening to the lobbyists and to the women that are going literally out of their way to make sure that, whether it's in the conferences or the big places where their voices are being heard, there is a progress in that sense. Because before President Trump called the whole thing off, they were almost ready to sign. We didn't know what was being signed. But now that they haven't signed that, it seems like there is a little bit of progress into, at least listening to what's happening around. At least the international community, Germany, for example, has a huge role in all of this. EU has a huge role in all of this. And they are giving platforms to women and Afghan women, and committees are being made. And then Germany, for example, brought this delegation to Doha so that they can speak behind the scenes. And these are progress. You can't always say that, okay, yeah, it's bad, bad, bad. Of course it's bad. 80% of it is bad. But every single percentile that is being that is going towards this possible, negotiations that women are involved and other civil society members are involved and religious minorities are involved, is a progress to me. It is much better than, let's say, 2 years ago when they were just ready to sign and give it all to the hands of the Taliban.
And this is, of course, part of what you are trying to do with your work, giving a platform of maybe making a little change for some of the women in Afghanistan, putting them on a stage and tell a story that is not that obvious in everyday news, right? That's why
exactly,
because, you returned.
Yes, because the news outlets, this kind of stuff, in inspiring stories of Afghan women, the other side of the coin, does not always sell. And I've been told this by, I have some very good friends in top-notch, media groups that have supported me in a lot of things, but they have told me behind the scene, and I know this, that they will not be able to, put this book, especially in the German media, in places where it should be, where, of course, that if you're on a certain show on TV about this book, all of a sudden, you have about 5,000 books that are selling the next day, and 5,000 books selling the next day means that 5,000 plus their network have heard about it. So this is how you spread the word. But I also know that it's a part of the game and the part of the marketing and branding part. That's why I still accept the tours, and it's in demand like there's no tomorrow. I go to the smallest village. I have been to the smallest village in places where you wouldn't think that an Afghan would. I don't think any Afghan ever went there. And I have been to the far right cities, especially in the Leipzig area, where we did a tour. I think it was last year or the year before, where they were from. We did these. The police even knew that we were coming. And we were talking about Afghanistan, the other Afghanistan, and the book was a part of it. And these places were packed, and you would have lots of right-wing extremists that were there, and they were coming up with questions such as, oh, why do your men come here and try to rape all our women? Things like that, just bluntly like that. But I allow these questions because whether you're far right or a right or a left, whatever your beliefs are, all of these questions come from a fear, from a place of fear. And if these people are not allowed to bluntly ask that question to somebody like me who is not a politician, Where in the world are they supposed to ask it? Why shouldn't we give them that? Of course, it's a horrible way of asking a question. But if I allow my ego to get into place and take that personally, then you can talk to these people and answer them in a way where they may go back and think twice. That is exactly the same way of changing a mindset that is in this extreme, I mean, to the right or to the left, that I have to deal with in Afghanistan, in a far, far, far village where they don't understand why a woman comes there and speaks to the men, where they can't even show me they're women because they're not supposed to see a man. Things like that. So I don't see any difference between that extremist and this extremist. There is extremism is extremism. Whatever kind of stamps and whatever kind of molds that have been built due to the fact that there's only one way of showing a story, the narrative has to change. And I think that the narrative through this book, especially in the places that I have been, because those same cities, I'm going in on the 25th of January for a presentation of something else. And on the 27th, that same, this is the third time I'm going to that city to talk about the same exact thing. And they ask you to come back because people are interested.
You are willing to confront such questions because you say, where else are they supposed to ask them? Where else can they challenge their own thinking? But of course, this realization doesn't mean that it is your responsibility to put yourself into this situation, to having to answer these questions and to deal with that. How do you make the decision that you are ready and willing and able to be in this position? Because to be confronted this way.
I wrote a book, and when I wrote the book, this is a part of the its responsibility basically. If I wrote a novel that was fiction, it's also storytelling. It's beautiful. I love it, you know. But I have never, to be honest, I don't think I've ever read a fiction novel that was not based on a true story, unless it was for my school. I don't like it. I like watching movies. I love watching movies. I'm a movie junkie, and I love the fictions and all of that. But documentaries are always, I have always been fascinated by nonfiction books. I mean, you give me nonfiction books, I can stay there. Novel, unless it's a movie where it's visual, not my thing. Mm-hmm. Not my thing. So when I decided to go into nonfiction books and documentaries and really realize them, I knew that marketing and branding is something that it comes to me naturally. Anyways, a strategy builder. I'm a strategy. I build strategies for whatever it needs to be done for the empowerment programs. The strategy of marketing of this book for me was my vision. What was my goal? For as many people as possible to actually realize what I mean, not to just read the book and see that there's like over 20, 22, like all ages and all sizes and all kinds of Afghan women that don't even correlate to each other. Like literally, they're not the same. But they do different things in different parts of the country. Some of them, one is illiterate, but runs a huge army, for example. And how is it possible that she's not even in one of these big cities, for example? She's in a remotest area, very conservative area where women don't even like read and write. They have no rights to speak, but she leads an army of men in that part of the country.
And she has done so for decades.
She's like 70, I think even now she's 75 years young, literally. So how is that possible? Because there's so many stories of this, and these women have inspired tons of other women. They are the first domino in the domino effect that is happening. That's why I called the film A Silent, We the Women of Afghanistan, A Silent Revolution. Because to the field, to the people that work in the field, people that I work with, my colleagues or whatever, worldwide, the ministers, the foreign ministers that go there, they know all of them. To them, it's not a silent revolution. I opened the film on the 8th of March in 2018 at the United Nations in New York. And one of the ministers, a Dutch minister, was there, Fluke. And she came and she did the opening remarks. And she said, I don't understand why Nahid called it a silent revolution, because this revolution was way long time ago. She only had a few minutes to speak and then she left. And when it was my turn, I said, well, it's because the mass doesn't know about this. only this, there were 11 delegations, 130, 40 people that were in the field and really ambassadors and all of, you know, the UN people and people that are in the field. You know it. Out there needs to know it. So out there means the tiniest little village that has a full packed event for the opening of this book. And the whole full packed event for that tiny little village is 30 to 50 people, which is huge. You get 30 to 50 people in Munich, it's a flop. But over there, it is a huge thing. The only newspaper, the only magazine that's there, we're all there. And they write about that. And the next day, they write about it more and more and more and more and more. And that is how you, I think it's a must for an author. If you call yourself the author and you have the privilege of being allowed to call yourself an author, it is also your responsibility to make sure that the reason why you wrote this book, and it's a lot of work, it's a lot of research, it's a lot of time, and you do not get rich writing nonfiction films, believe me, nonfiction books, then make sure that your voice is heard and make time for that. So for me, I didn't write the book to become rich or to become famous or anything like that. I wrote the book because it was a voice that needed to be heard. Just like all of my initiations, all of my things, what I do, my work is a social impact work. It has to impact these, it has to close these gaps that we have. We try to, you know, fill these gaps that is in such big need. And today I live in Germany. I pay my taxes in Germany. Most of my life now, I can say that it's no longer Canada. Most of my life I've lived in Germany. My daughters are born here. As a citizen that lives and takes the positive things, there's lots of great positive things that the German state gives me. What do I give it back? Isn't that my duty as a citizen? Shouldn't we all be thinking about that? What do you give back? I mean, everything that I have learned, whether it's in these institutions or in my trips or whatever, it's all borrowed knowledge from other people. Maybe 5% of it I added to my, maybe if I'm lucky, you know, whatever wisdom that you get, maybe when I'm 80 years old, I'll get something and I'll put that 5% on it. You never know. But all of this is just a privilege for me to go and learn and see all of that stuff. What do I do with it? Sleep on it? What a waste. Give it back. Because others have given it back. So you and I, Eric, are sitting down here because somebody made these idea of podcasts. Somebody made these idea of books that I, you know, storytelling. It's not my idea. I took it from somewhere and I made it my own. And I delivered it to the world in hopes that somebody else takes that and delivers it in a completely different way. That is called evolution of human beings.
And you have met some beautiful and very interesting human beings for your book. And of course, that is also part of what you said. Yeah. You collect stuff, to put it very informally, that is already there, information, mm-hmm. story, wisdom, truth, whatever. And you put it together to transport a message or mm-hmm. to tell a story. And some of these characters or protagonists in your book are really very memorable. And unfortunately, we won't have the time to get into great detail. I would have been willing to do that. But of course, yeah, the book tells the story in more detail for German listeners, unfortunately, only at the moment. But for example, you met the first Afghan conductor, which is... Yes. A very interesting chapter. And just as a reminder, like 15 years before that, right, that when the Taliban ruled, music was completely forbidden mm-hmm. in Afghanistan. Yeah, yeah. So this is very powerful to see.
And also
this.
That she was a teenager when yes. she became the first female
yes.
conductor.
Yes.
And supported by a man. And yes. that is very important in Afghan culture yes. as well. In these cultures, basically in the Eastern cultures, if you do not have the support, the full support of male, you know,
yeah.
it won't work. So there are, this is another taboo that has to be broken. Not all men do, you know, what you hear that they do to the women and suppress their women and they don't allow their women to do this and that. That is also false. Not all do that. We have some great men that support all of these things. Of course, it's a culture that is different than yours, but is all Western cultures? I mean, are all Western cultures the same? No. I came from Canada. From Montreal, La Belle Ville de Montréal. I grew up there. And I came from Canada to Germany, to Munich, to Bavaria, which is a completely different country than Germany altogether, to be honest, for those that know the country. I had to integrate myself. I didn't come from Afghanistan. I came from a Western culture where I grew up and I spoke already four or five languages. And I came here and I learned my sixth. And it was hard. And it was completely different. It was so conservative. I found my peace after 20 years of living here. So why do we expect something different from a country like Afghanistan just because it's in a war zone? Just because there's been a war for 40 years? Wars that have absolutely nothing to do with any Afghan at the end of the day, if you really go into it. These wars have absolutely nothing to do with any Afghan living on this planet, but has changed the course of life for every single Afghan on this planet. And it was not by choice.
You also met the first female Afghan 3D graffiti artist, for example.
Yes.
You also met the first, or one of the first, young military pilots, female pilots.
She was really cool.
Yes, and it was also really challenging to even get the interview done, right? I mean, there are so many stories around the stories.
Yeah, for sure.
Yes.
But the Germans would say, the red thread that you find in every single one of them, is that fear is not an aspect. Hmm. We've talked about this, and fear is the limitation that we put on ourselves. But in this case, I mean, Nahid goes there to interview these incredible women. She comes there with her six languages and a few, you know, degrees and this portfolio and blah, blah, blah. And I go to sit in front of a 12-year-old and I interview her and I feel so small because this 12-year-old speaks to me as if she has seen the world over 100 years with the wisdom of a 100-year-old. And the values and the things that comes out of her, this girl's mouth, and what she wants to do in order to change life for other young women like her. She's only 12, for God's sakes. Speak to a 12-year-old here and see what comes out. I'm not generalizing, but of course a war kind of awakens this survival instinct and makes you an adult within days. That's what happened to me. Those 5 days and four nights over the mountains truly robbed me of my childhood. I always say this.
Despite the fact that you perceived it as a great adventure?
Yes, because I realized after when we got on the mountain, on the last mountain, and there was a frontier, you could see it. And I'll never forget that my grandfather asked us, he said, turn around, because, you know, he was older and he knew what was happening. He said, turn around, look at this country, look at your birthplace, because it may be the last time that you see it. It was the last time that he saw it, because he passed. But I remember that moment did something to me. That moment, literally. I remember as if it was yesterday. It's like a film in my head that's running all the time. And I remember how it looked. Only mountaintops, beautiful mountaintops. You would never think that there was a huge war raging that changed the course of humanity, basically. That tiny little country, Afghanistan, all of a sudden, the whole world knows where Jalalabad and Kandahar are. But nobody knew what an Afghan was before that. And that's, I remember that it was just silence. Silence, pure silence. Nobody spoke a word for a few seconds. And that's when I realized I knew I was going to come back. I knew I wanted to do this. I always knew that I was going to go back to Afghanistan. And I swore that I would come back. Something happened in those few seconds where, of course, I was like a little child and do all of these mischiefs and everything in Canada and be a teenager, blah, blah, blah. But my goal never changed. Regardless of whether I played volleyball, I did this, I went to school, I went to high school. The fact that I had that in the back of my mind still amazes me. Still amazes me. Because I remember, because I played beach volleyball for Canada. We did the qualifications and I had the flag of Canada on my chest.
Yes.
So I represented Canada on the world tour in 2000 with my partner. Girls team. And I remember that I made sure that there was absolutely no picture taken of me because I knew that the beach volleyball attire would not be approved and it would come back and bite me one day. There's absolutely no picture of me that you can find anywhere in this world with that bikini. But I played my love. And today I fight for these idiocy, how you can stamp. For me, it was about the sport and the love for sport. But I knew that if I go back to Afghanistan and all of those places that I wanted to work and do the things that I wanted to do, that could be a barrier. And that was a construction site that I would not have time for, and I don't care for it. So I mean, I don't know how, but I always had that in mind. So I made sure that there was absolutely no picture of mine. For example, this is just one of the examples.
It's an amazing foresight.
Yeah, but yes. It was as if it was like a, I didn't know how. I didn't know when, but I knew that I would, because that was always in the back of my mind. I visualized it all the time. I visualized my book. I visualized my, I even visualized, I swear to God, I visualized standing at the Oscars and accepting an Oscar for a film that I made. I have visualized it since I was 12. And the power of visualization, I know this because I incorporate it into my empowerment programs when I give it. It does actually work, because the other visualization things have all come true. Who knows? Who knows? But yes. Even, I mean, the Oscars, of course, I mean.
It's a symbol.
Let's just take it for as an example, just hypothetically speaking. I never said, okay, I want this as achievements. No, because these achievements, like we said before we started this podcast, when I knock on a door, it opens because of these things. The things don't matter to me because, for example, the diplomas that we talked about before, I opened this box and my university diploma, and I remember that the university called me. I think I was living in Germany back then. They sent me an email and they called home in Canada and they said, is Nahid even interested in picking up her diploma? I had not picked up any of my diplomas. My college diploma was somewhere. We had to go to the archives the next time that I flew to Canada in order to get my diplomas. It's not important to me. I know I have it. But I know that that diploma opens a couple of doors that I need for my big vision and my missions. That's what an Oscar does. People listen to you. A UN would not have opened their doors if I did not do the things that I did. And this is something that one of my We the Women of Germany, because I did We the Women of Germany in 2009 or something, one of my women, Regina Sixt, Regina is a very good friend, and she told me, she said, Nahid, if I hadn't done all of these things, would you do me this honor of giving, like taking me and putting me as one of the We the Women of Germany? That was the question that she asked me. And that clicked. That clicked, and it kind of... it was a confirmation to everything that I had done, didn't even know that I had done it. The achievements and these papers and these things that I don't know about the rest of the world why they do it. I know that I do it because I know that it would open the doors that I need, the ultimate doors that I need in order to pursue my projects. Oh, I haven't even started scratching the surface of the ice. There's so many ideas I have. Seriously. And I know that you need the work. You need the work. You need the discipline. You need, and above all, you need the network. You need the supporters. Nobody has made it up there without somebody else, you know, taking their hand. And that is why it's so important that a lot of people contact me to help them. Of course, we filter because there's a lot of people that, you know, waste your time as well. And a lot of people don't understand that we cannot answer everybody, but those that I have a feeling for, and I take the time to talk to them. Sometimes, you know, they have the discipline and the hard work, because it is a lot of hard work and discipline, and sometimes they don't. But I do try to see, okay, who can I help? But I don't help everybody, I'll be honest, because you don't know. They have to pay their dues. They have to pass the tests, because these are not easy tests. And when they do, then I will take them by the hand and put them up there whenever they need to, which I have done.
You mentioned that you have so many ideas for more projects. What is the best way to follow you and to keep up to date with the projects that you are involved in? Is there a good way?
Well, I know this now, and I can say it firmly and with confidence and at peace when I say that I know that I overwhelm a lot of people when I speak. I have had to learn how to pace my speech even, because I speak extremely fast. My brain works a lot faster than my speech. So to me, in my head, everything is very structured. everything. I know exactly which strategy is for what. Why am I doing this today and tomorrow? It may be for the next 2 years. And the other thing is this. So yes, there are art projects that are coming, but my art and my paintings will be mostly, not all, but mostly for social impact initiatives. It has been in the past few years, as you know, as you followed. And it is a passion of mine. I've painted for the past, I think, over 30 years now. And yes, they do, you know, whenever I need, basically, a lot of people say that, and a few friends of mine, whenever I need money, then I paint. But it's okay. It pays for a few bills and a few projects. So there is a couple of painting projects that I'm working on because I miss it. Mm-hmm. I always love putting something away for a couple of years and then miss it so badly that you go and passionately and create something completely new. There is a Iraq is also in my agenda. I do intend on going back. There's one project that I'm consulting, but there are a couple of projects that I want to start, but in a mass way, meaning that the numbers of people that it would affect would be in 100,000s. And there is a couple of projects that I'm working on. Actually, I've been working on for the past 2 years, for Afghanistan. But Iraq in Kurdistan, it's to a certain degree stable. So you can kind of plan. In Afghanistan, it keeps on setting back because of security. So, for the past 2 years, I have been planning to go there at least 3 or 4 times, and within 1 week I've had to cancel things because of the bombs and these protests and all of these things that are happening there. So, but I'm still not giving up, and I have found a way to be able to do the work, especially in Afghanistan, while being away. Mm-hmm. So whether it's e-education or e-projects, so through the electronic, thank God for the technology today. So you can do it. I found a way. But the empowerment projects for Germany, which is especially for the sports ones, which is my love, is very important to me. So that I do these, I've done a few pilots, and the pilots are there because it's a completely different program. It's just because I need to be confident enough, me myself. I have to be confident enough that, yes, Nahid, you own it. Now you go. So because I can't be everywhere. I have to find the people that have the same kind of language as me, so that they can run the programs, so that I can, they don't need to be taught. They just have to be, you know, delegated. Mm-hmm. So, I'm in that process right now. So it's a long process, and I don't want to do the same mistake that I've done in the past decade, let's say, to push something impatiently because I wanted to launch it. So I don't need to prove anything to anybody anymore, which is a great place to be. And before, like, let's say about 6-7 years ago, I was always concerned about, oh my God, I've talked about this on social media. Now I have to launch it and I have to launch it and I have to launch it. I've made mistakes that way. And right now, to be honest, even if these empowerment programs, I mean, they're already launched. I don't need to do an event to launch it. I have already launched it. I'm already working with teams and with individuals and with groups and all of that stuff. So for this year, Germany is one of my, you know, my concentrations, because I see the gaps, the same gaps in these young women and young girls, the same gaps that I see in Afghanistan and Iraq. They have it here as well.
And how far?
Mental health, mental training, emotional control, the focus, the time management, stress management, all of those things that we work with, you know, brings other problems in a couple of years. And often we ask ourselves, oh my God, where is this mental health issue coming from? For God's sakes, we were talking about this before as well. And I said, you know, we live in 2020 now. The education system that we have in most of the world has been built 100 years ago. But we put our kids into these systems expecting them to excel for the 2020 era, where most of their jobs, when they graduate, are not even created yet, have not even been created yet. So they are working into a system blindly, learning the basics of everything for an era that doesn't even know how to cope with it. We don't even know how to cope with it, because there's the mobility, it changes so fast. The technology, the things that are happening, you know, I'm not an iPhone generation, but you are. My daughter is. And we have to learn. I go to my daughter whenever there's like an app new. I have no idea how it works. It's not my field. I just use it to get to my means. They don't know how it worked when I didn't have my laptop and I had to go and put my name in the computer lab in the university so that I could have an hour so that I can finish my paper on computer and print it in these old school print shops, which you could barely read. So, and this is not far ago. This is only 20 years ago. I was in university 20, 25 years ago. How are we supposed to predict? We can predict to a certain degree, but you cannot predict that much because of everything that has been changing so fast in this new era. So the gaps that we have is the mental part. The social medias, the Facebook and co have also created a lot of problems. As good as they are for, publicity, all of that stuff, there's good and bad in everything. But we have created a very unstable and not confident young people where they live in a filtered world, which is fake. They go into lengths where they put needles and cut their physique in order to, to fit a certain category of that is supposed to be stamped as beauty. Our idea of beauty has changed, and everybody wants to be, this and that because of this and that, but there's no depth into anything anymore. 30 seconds, 60 seconds is too long for an ad because your brain does not have the capacity to keep that attention span. What are we doing to these young kids? How are they coping with this? They put these filtered things, and then all of a sudden they go into the side of the mirror. What do you think happens to that brain of theirs? It's not even developed yet. They already have a lot of construction sites in their brains due to puberty, due to this. Neuroscience and data, everything proves it to us. And we're still watching. How long are we going to watch? Until we change the systems and actually make it as a very important component and element of the institutionalized education system. We have to incorporate these things into the institutions, whether it's meditation, whether it's mental health issues, whether it's just techniques, habits that they can do in order to manage their stress, manage their time. We give them these social media stuff. I didn't have the social media, so therefore, it was either TV, which I didn't have time for, or sports. Mm-hmm. Today, these social media accounts rob our kids of their lives because they're watching other people live. What about your own life? But if you just, and it's not bad, but you just have to control it and add elements that is going to help them cope with this because it's new to all of them. And at that age, you do not make always the right decisions. So have it implemented. This mental health issue is a huge thing. For God's sakes, we have to act and put it into the institutions and educational systems because it's only for the rich, basically. If you have the money, you can hire a great strategist, a great life coach, a great motivational speaker, whatever it is, and for a group of people and pay 125 euros minimum per hour to get the support that you need. But what is the percentage of rich people that can afford that? It's 120 per hour or 25 per hour of a therapist or 125 euros of food on your table per week for your children. Which one are you going to go for? So these are the issues that I think are really, really important when it comes to my empowerment programs, mm-hmm. because I build these empowerment programs on a lot of data, on a lot of years of research. And also I did them in Afghanistan for different things, but for fundraising. But the red thread is the same. When you put this emotional control, nobody teaches you these things. So why don't we wait? What are we waiting for? So I want to find a way. I have found a way to work with, right now it's with sports. So empower these young girls that are already doing sports, but teach them how to cope with their emotions, with their focus, with their all, and that they take it with them in all aspects of their lives. So that's one, for example. So I'm very, very excited about that one. It's very, very important to me because I also because I've been through it, and also I have two daughters that are, almost past the teeny one is going to be like they're going to be 18 and 15, and that's a very, very crucial time in your life, so that you consciously know these things, and then you can make the right or close to right decisions, or make fewer mistakes. Let's say that.
I can definitely feel the passion that you have for this project, and also I could feel the passion in your stories before and in your book. And yes, I thank you so much for also showing the passion to tell us about all of this.
Oh,
it was a very, very nice conversation. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.